Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Blagojevich. Mr. Goodman.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leonard Goodman. I represent, along with Lauren Caseberg, Rod Blagojevich on this appeal. In our brief, we've laid out numerous errors which we believe made Mr. Blagojevich's trial fundamentally unfair. But I would like to focus the core of my argument this morning on the erroneous jury instructions and related rulings, including the issue of good faith, which we submit requires reversal of all of the counts of conviction at the retrial. Every crime has a mens rea, which the government must prove. Here, the government was required to prove intent to defraud, intent to extort. This court has held that there is a requirement that that the defendant knows he is doing something wrong. Here, the jury was told explicitly that it didn't need to make such a finding. And Mr. Blagojevich was barred from telling the jury his good faith belief that his conduct comported with the law.
What in the language of the statute says it matters whether he is unaware of the law's requirements? You rely heavily on Cheek. Mm-hmm. In Cheek, the word was willful. Any of the statutes here have that word in it?
Judge, we are not relying exclusively on Cheek, because I understand.
Not exclusively, but my question remains. Any of the statutes here make willfulness a legal requirement?
There is a knowing requirement. And
no.
This,
I wish you would answer my question. You can answer it yes or no, and then you can tell me what you think its significance is, but you need to answer the question.
I would agree that Cheek is distinguished, and I don't...
Would you answer my question? Does any of the statutes here have the word willful in it?
I don't believe so.
All right. Now, you can tell me why you don't think that matters.
But as you do, Mr. Goodman, keep in mind that the offenses that were charged were not ones that required proof of willfulness.
Yes. I understand that. And if I may begin, the centerpiece of the government's case was that Blagojevich attempted to make a deal with Barack Obama where he would appoint the president-elect's choice for the Senate, and in exchange, President Obama would put him in his cabinet. The government does not dispute that such a deal has, for exchanging an official act for a political appointment, has never, as far as we can tell, been prosecuted as a crime. Yet Blagojevich's jury was told in no uncertain terms.
Then you should make as your argument the contention that that's not a violation of these statutes, and you need to deal with the language of the statutes. But the usual rule that ignorance of the law is no excuse seems to be as applicable here as it is to every other person. Willfulness, when the statute requires knowledge of the law's requirements, you get a word like willful. So I think that your best strategy might be to argue the merits of your point rather than to try to get us to insert into the statute a word that isn't there.
Yes, I agree with that, Judge. And I just want to be clear that Mr. Blagojevich is not asserting an ignorance of the law defense. He never did. He never said, I thought
That's
it was...
That's what his good faith defense is, counsel. It's, if I believed what I was doing had evaded the law, then I'm entitled to be acquitted. That's an ignorance of the law defense by a different name. That's why I'm urging you to discuss the merits rather than to deal with a word that's not in the statute.
Judge, first of all, I would respectfully disagree, because my understanding of an ignorance of the law defense would be, I thought it was okay to commit bribery. I thought it was okay to commit extortion. I thought it was okay to commit fraud. What Mr. Blagojevich's defense was, is I thought this was a political horse trade. I did not think this was bribery, extortion, and fraud.
Well, out of the political sense, though, would the same thing apply if it weren't a political arrangement?
Well, as to the law, this court has the fact that it's a political appointment does have significance. I would agree. And we would argue that existing precedents strongly suggest that this was not a crime. And first of all, if you look at the bribery statute and this court's pattern instruction, there is an exemption for bona fide wages. And in fact, the instruction reads, bona fide salary, wages, or other compensation in the course of business does not qualify as a thing of value by the defendant.
You see, the problem that we've got to get to, I think, is that the jurors didn't have to accept that Mr. Blagojevich was attempting to trade the appointment of Ms. Jarrett for a job in the Obama administration as an effort to further the public interest as he understood it. And when he made that comment on November 11th, you know, so we know he wants her, meaning Mr. Obama, wants her, they're not willing to give me anything except appreciation, you know, F them. Doesn't that tend to show that he was acting for private gain rather than any sort of public interest?
Well, certainly the government highlights, you know, they had 8 phone lines tapped for 40 days. They highlight excerpts which support that theory. But I would disagree that the tapes make clear, and certainly we make the argument that there was abundant evidence that was excluded at trial, make clear that his concern, yes, he was concerned about supporting his family, but his primary concern was political. He wanted, he believed in advocating for issues that he cared about. He wanted positions where he could continue that political work.
Tell me this. Does the fact that he would have been making roughly $20,000 more per year as Secretary of Health and Human Services, does that matter? Would that have been viewed as private gain?
I would say no. And I mean, first of all, the jury was not asked to make this decision. This issue was taken away from the jury. The jury was told quite specifically that any attempt to exchange an official act for a job that earns a potential salary, he is guilty. There was no exception. The jury wasn't asked to make an evaluation. Was this really corrupt? Was this for private gain? No. The jury was told absolutely, if he tried to do it for a job, he is guilty. And what I would urge the court, besides the pattern jury instruction and the bona fide wages, this court in Thompson also did look at and say quite specifically public employees' regular compensation improved through above-board channels is not a private gain, as that is contemplated by this court in Bloom. And then in the Sekhart case, the Supreme Court also looked at further restrictions on extortion, that the object of an extortion must be transferable property.
See, as I understand your argument, when both parties to the quid pro quo are political figures, it's mere horse riding. But if one party is not a political figure, it is a crime. Well, maybe that describes a political tradition, but why does it make sense as legal doctrine?
I'm sorry, Judge. If one party is...
If one party isn't a political figure, it seems to be a crime.
Well, certainly... This court has looked at corrupt deals where a politician, and for example, there's cases that we cite in the brief where there's clearly corrupt deals where a politician is doing favors for a private corporation in return for favors, and those favors could include a job. That is a different
situation. For racetrack settings.
Pardon me?
Time, dates for racing.
Time and dates.
For racing. You're talking about corruption where the governor sets the schedule for a racing schedule. Horse factory.
Yes.
That's a crime.
The governor sets the schedule for racing?
Well, where for a bribe, for a contribution, the favorable racetrack, the settings for times for holding races in the state of Illinois.
There's no question that if there's a quid pro quo in exchange for a campaign contribution, that is a crime. A campaign contribution in exchange for official act, a bribe in exchange for an official act, we don't dispute any of that.
What's the status with regard to the let's use Mr. Blagojevich's use of his campaign funds. Does the state of Illinois cover that, or is that a federal statute, or how does that work? Can he use that money for his own purposes?
The state of Illinois governs that, and no, he cannot. My understanding is no, he cannot. I mean, it's not an issue in this case.
In other words, if $50,000 is given to his campaign fund, he can't use that for travel or something else.
My understanding is no. And in fact, in this case, there is absolutely no allegation that Mr. Blagojevich abused his campaign fund.
Well, right. There's no indication that money was paid, as far as
no. But there is no allegation at all. I mean, he reimbursed his fund for travel for his family. There is no allegation. This is not a case of stealing money from his campaign fund. And I think to address Judge Easterbrook's issue, you know, this court does recognize. And the government concedes there is an advice of counsel defense. So if there is an advice of counsel defense, then that suggests it's a recognition that a subjective understanding of the law matters. The defendant here, and this court has said, it's not an actual defense. It's basically evidence attacking the mens rea that the government has the burden to prove. Here, Blagojevich relied on a related defense of good faith. This court has stated good faith is a legitimate, valid defense in specific intent crimes. We're not saying we're entitled to the elevated burden that is recognized in Cheek for highly complicated statutes. But the government did have to prove that he had some knowledge of wrongdoing, as this court stated in Ladon.
Let's go back to Thompson for a minute, because I know you feel that that's very helpful. But in Thompson, we have a state employee who did what she thought her superiors wanted her to do in order to keep her job and then get a promotion through normal channels, whereas it would seem as if what happened here is the naked trade of an official act filling the Senate seat for what he thought would be a better job, whether it was more powerful, whether it was more public, whether it was just different for himself. So the fact that he wanted the job that he wanted was public and subject to transparent confirmation process hardly seems to foreclose the government's theory, given that there was only one person that could give him that job, and that was the President of the United States.
Your Honor.
So if you could help me with
yes,
that.
Yes. We're not...
We're not
asking this court to find that no political deal for an appointment could ever be criminal. And we're not saying that Thompson holds that. But what we are arguing, first of all, it was an issue for the jury. It was taken away from the jury. The jury was told specifically, any job, doesn't matter. You don't have to decide if this was corrupt or for private gain. Secondly, he had a valid good faith defense. This court has a pattern good faith instruction, which says good faith on the part of the defendant is inconsistent with intent to defraud, an element of the charges. The burden is not on the defendant to prove his good faith. Rather, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant acted with the intent to defraud. At the retrial, the district court allowed the government to rewrite that instruction and to effectively become a government theory of prosecution instruction. The government added two sentences to that instruction. First, the government is not required to prove the defendant knew his acts were unlawful. And secondly, and more problematic, we would argue, in the context of this case, good faith means that the defendant acted without intending to exchange official acts for personal benefits. There was absolutely no legal basis for the government to give such an for the court to give such an instruction. The government cites no authority for it. The government argues, well, it was consistent with the defense that he actually presented. Well, only because the district court prohibited him from presenting the defense that he wanted to present. The erroneous good faith instruction applied to every single count at the retrial. And because Blagojevich had effectively conceded that he did intend to make a deal with Barack Obama for the seat, the instruction told the jury that in deliberating on every single count at the retrial, defendant was not operating in good faith. The harm to these defense instructions cannot be overstated and was increased at trial by rulings of the court essentially gutting his good faith defense. And there's three critical facts I would like the court to bring to the court's attention. First, the court allowed the government to put on evidence suggesting that Blagojevich knew that a deal for an appointment violated the law. The government put on evidence that he received ethics training, which told him you can't accept any gifts, you can't accept even a free drink or a meal. The government argued to the jury, Blagojevich knew you can't trade state actions for free bar drinks, so somehow he was mistaken that he could trade it for a cabinet-level position that paid over $100,000. The district court then told the defendant on the record several times, it's cited in our brief, if you testify, you can get on the stand and rebut the government's position. You can get on the stand and, quote, say, I looked at the law and I thought this was legal. Third, after the defendant got on the stand, took the stand, and began to testify, the judge changed the ruling, literally pulled the rug out from under him, and said, no, I've changed my mind. Your opinions about the legality of something is out. I don't want to see it by implication. And the judge confined his good faith defense to basically the fact he had already conceded. This is all you're allowed to contest, that you didn't intend to do an exchange. Well, he had already conceded that he intended to do an exchange. He was literally left on the stand with no defense. The government doesn't even dispute that this was unfair. The government says, well, the unfairness was somehow invited by Blagojevich because he didn't follow the court's rules. And as we point out in the reply brief, there is simply no evidence, there is simply no support in the record for that position.
I think that what the government is saying as to the the two sentences, it is in part that only the cheek willfulness setting would, only in that setting would it be erroneous. The second sentence, of course, gives me some pause.
Now, we argue that these rulings deprive Mr. Blagojevich of his right to defend himself, and that the error could not be found harmless under these circumstances.
Well,
and that,
there's a series of things. I mentioned the racetrack thing. That was one aspect. There's the cabinet position. There's the Jesse Jackson issue. And there seemed to be a time constraint. The campaign contributions and other things he wanted to have done now. He wanted to get out of the governorship, right?
Well, there's some suggestion, but really the time constraint on the had to do with a bill passed by the state of Illinois, which said that after January 1st of 2009, he could no longer collect contributions from the people that had been contributing to him his whole term as governor. So, yes, there was some urgency. There's no question about that. Now, we would argue that his good faith defense would have been a powerful defense if he had allowed to give it. And again, he's not saying he was ignorant of the law. He said, I believed this was political horse trading. This was appropriate conduct. This was not fraud. And my understanding of the law is based on my understanding of politics. that horse trading is necessary sometimes to accomplish goals. And here we're talking about political goals, not just cash in his pocket.
Well, let me take you back again. I mentioned it had been fairly inarticulate apparently about the horse race thing, but there was a subsidy being granted from slots to.
Yes, there was a subsidy which benefited the racetracks.
All right.
And I will address that if you'd like. I mean, that has to do with the extortion, and I was going to talk about the extortion instructions in a moment.
I won't interrupt you. You can go ahead and finish your own.
All right. Mr. Blagojevich's defense was that he was relying on understanding of politics, his reading of history. Mr. Blagojevich is an avid history reader, and he cited and in his offer of proof, six historical examples. And I would submit to this court, they're compelling examples. And he was relying on discussions with lawyers and consultants. And the excluded evidence would have powerfully supported this. It showed that he discussed all of these deals, the 501c4, the Senate seat, the Health and Human Services. He discussed them openly, not just with his inner circle, but with outside people, Jerry Reinsdorf, Denny Hastert. This was not some backroom deal that where the smoke clears, he thought he was going to be Health and Human Services Secretary. And the defendant's good faith position is made more powerful by the fact that there is no contrary established authority that says that a deal for a political appointment is a crime. And I would...
But we have to look at not just who he spoke to, but the words that he used when he was speaking to these people. And, you know, on the telephone,
If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to address the extortion, if that's where you're going.
Yes.
First of all, these extortion counts all involve campaign contributions. And this is a critical point here. The McCormick case, which is from 1991, solicitation of campaign contributions rise to the level of extortion only if the payments are made in return for an explicit promise or undertaking. This court's pattern instructions make clear that when the case involves campaign contributions, an instruction comporting with a McCormick should be given. In the case at bar, the district court ignored that. He gave the instruction that Blagojevich is guilty if he asked for a donation knowing or believing that it would be given to him in return for the taking of a specific official action. This was prejudicial error for three reasons. First of all, the knowing and believing language is nearly identical to the language rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in McCormick. The Supreme Court and the jury was instructed in McCormick. If McCormick knew that the campaign contribution was made with the expectation that McCormick's official action would be influenced, then he is guilty. The Supreme Court said that is not adequate in a campaign contribution case. The McGregor case, which we rely heavily on, and the lawyers relied heavily on at trial, says an even more rigorous standard is required in one-sided solicitation cases, like the case at bar. That is cases where we basically have an unfulfilled ask, no meeting of the minds. The court said a heightened burden is required on the government to avoid misinterpretation by the donor of an ask. And that's what we have here. The government argues that this lower knowing and believing standard was approved in Giles, but this court knows if you look at the Giles case, that was not a campaign contribution case. That was a bribery case. And in that case, this court specifically said that if the issue, in a case involving campaign contribution, it makes sense, quote, it makes sense to require the government to prove that a particular contribution was made in exchange for an explicit promise or undertaking. Now, to compound the error in this case, the jury was given another non-pattern instruction which said anything of value may include campaign contributions. And the government exploited this fully. They told the jury repeatedly A request for campaign donations is identical to a request for cash bribes. Campaign contributions personally benefit Blagojevich. The jury was told there is no difference. It's the same. When he asked for a campaign contribution, it's the same as a police officer asking for a bribe to tear up a ticket.
Save some of your time.
Okay. I will. Thank you.
Goodman?
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning.
I want to start you right out, if I might.
Yes, you may.
I'm sorry.
Of course.
But is there another case with facts like this in which the proposal is for two elected public officials to trade appointments and the court treats the appointment sought in exchange for a favor of another as private gain? Politics in part is about winning friends, influencing people, using the appointment power. It's sort of a time-honored way in which politicians do just that, is it not?
Well, Your Honor, two questions presented there. Let me answer the first one first. The government is unaware of a reported decision with facts identical to the facts presented here.
You're unaware because there
is the word is not identical. If the facts to be identical, all the litigants in the other case would have to be named Blagojevich. Judge Rogner's question, which is mine also, is there any earlier case in which there was a criminal conviction based on a promise to swap one political job for another, where one politician approaches another and says, if you appoint me or my friend, I'll appoint you or your friend? Is there any criminal conviction in U.S. history that rests on that kind of proposal?
I'm aware of none, Your Honor.
Sure. Elected officials often have their eye on the next job, trading their power as fundraisers, or in this case as office holders with the ability to do a favor. It's just one way to open the door to a better or different office. So is it legal to do that in your view, as long as there's no spoken quid pro quo? Where's the line? If you could help me with this, I'd be so grateful. Where is the line that differentiates legal horse trading from a federal offense that puts you in prison?
Well, Your Honor, I think the line is provided by the statutes, and the question here is the fundamental question with respect to all three statutes under which the defendant was convicted was whether there was essentially an exchange of an official act for money, property, or a thing of value, grouping all three of them together.
So is it your view that the $20,000 differential between the two jobs that were being discussed would equal personal enrichment? Is that your view? What?
That's one way to look at it. But
then you've got a lot of trouble with Thompson, which said that extra money for a public job is not property or a thing of value for that purpose.
I would distinguish Thompson, as we did in the brief, on a number of grounds related to this specific point. And one of them is that in the case of Thompson, it wasn't a new job. It was a regular step increase approved under...
It was a step increase for an existing job, but it was still more money than before. And we said that more money than before in a real public job that you're really performing, not as a ghost worker, is not a thing of value for this purpose.
But what was...
Counsel, let me tell you what lies behind my concern. There's a very famous historical example. Earl Warren became Chief Justice of the United States because before the Republican political convention in 1952, he approached an intermediary representing Dwight Eisenhower and proposed a deal. The deal was that Warren would deliver the California delegation and vote to seat Eisenhower delegates in five contested states, in exchange for which Eisenhower, if elected, would appoint him to the next vacancy on the Supreme Court. That's in Warren biographies. It's in Eisenhower biographies. It's pretty well established that that happened. If I understand your position, Earl Warren should have gone to prison, Dwight Eisenhower should have gone to prison, and Herbert Brownell, the intermediary who became Dwight Eisenhower's first attorney general, should have gone to prison. Can that possibly be right?
No. And I don't think that
What's different between that trade and this? Warren wanted a job for himself. It was a higher visibility job. It paid more. It was a swap of political support for a political favor by somebody who might become president and did.
It was a swap of political support, whereas in this case, the swap involved a political appointment that was an official act.
Chief Justice of the United States is a political appointment that is an official act.
But
you can't distinguish Secretary of HHS from Chief Justice of the United States on that kind of ground.
I agree with that, but political support in the form of delivering a delegation is not an official act. It is not a political appointment. It is not something of value.
Oh. You don't think Eisenhower got any value out of becoming President of the United States?
I think he did,
This proposed trade was a trade of the Presidency of the United States for a position on the Supreme Court. That's what it was all about. It would be an act of shysterism to try to say that was okay, and what Blagojevich did in the proposed trade of an appointment to the Senate for an appointment to HHS was not okay.
Well,
the line between that and this can't be the distinction between historical honor and felon status.
Well, we agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, one fundamental difference here, though, is that the HHS position was not a separate, it was not the basis of any of the separate charges. And it played no role in any of the executions.
That actually worries me. I mean, one of the things I tried to look at was, if you look at the Valerie Jarrett charges, the charge is that the defendant promised to swap the appointment of Valerie Jarrett for a number of things. One was appointment at HHS. The other was money, several million dollars to create a foundation. One of them, if Earl Warren was not a felon, one of them was not a crime, and the other was. Are there counts that can be sustained on the latter ground exclusively disregarding the former ground?
Yes, Your Honor. The five of the fraud counts, all the fraud counts except for the counts that involve the five and six, all other than five and six, and the count that involved Jesse Jackson, all relied on executions that dealt solely with the 501c4 seed money. All of those counts stand alone. They have nothing to do with this.
But do you not see a bleed over?
No. We don't, because, for one thing, the factual evidence here was that the initial ask, the initial conversations involved any number of different benefits. With the goal, Blagojevich's goal was to obtain something for himself in return for that Senate seat. And he wasn't really all that particular about what it was going to be. Sure, HHS sounded the best to him as things bubbled up to the surface. And that was the initial ask that he made. But that ask was effectively denied almost immediately.
Yeah, let me rephrase my question. Suppose the jury honestly believes that Blagojevich made the offer to swap the appointment for the cabinet job and did not agree to accept any money, or did not make that offer.
That could not be the case, Your Honor, because the jury...
Your position is the jury could not have convicted on any count if that were true, if the jury believed that?
I think you could argue, and I would disagree with it, but you could argue that that could be true only of counts 5 and 6. Because those were the counts where the execution of the fraud, those were fraud counts, where the execution were two phone calls in which Blagojevich discussed with a number of other people a myriad of options. Our argument would be that none of them could be segregated, that the conversation involved maybe this, maybe that, maybe this, maybe that. The whole idea of it was a more generalized conversation about getting something for himself in exchange for the Senate seat. But those two counts did not involve a conversation about the 501c4 seed money, because that issue was developed later. That idea was developed later. All of the remaining fraud counts that related to the appointment of Valerie Jarrett expressly relied on an execution involving the 501c4 seed money. So you could make the argument that you're making with respect to the counts 5 and 6 only, and that would be it. And we would argue that that would not be appropriate either, because there's no reason to believe that the jury would be looking at a conversation like this where a bunch of ideas are discussed and the tenor and the goal of the conversation is to arrive at an idea.
Well, you know, there's been some argument as to whether there was a genuine quid pro quo as to the appointment of then-Congressman Jackson. And I take it that it's your view that Mr. Blagojevich instructed his brother to meet with Mr. Nyack, and when he did, once he did, that he had, in effect, signaled his acceptance of the quid pro quo that Nyack proposed, notwithstanding the fact that the meeting was later called off. I know you're going to tell me it's the timing, but is that it?
Yes, Your Honor, that is it. And the conversation's pretty clear about that. The defendant stated or sent his brother and instructed his brother to tell him that Jackson was a reasonable likelihood, a viable candidate, but to explain that some of this stuff has got to start coming now. And what had been discussed, the defendant is on tape numerous times, what they were offering was $1.5 million. In one conversation, he says specific numbers and such. And it was very, very clear that that's what was being discussed. In any event, the jury most definitely had enough evidence upon which it could decide that that was the case, and in fact, that is exactly what they decided.
Do you want to talk about horse racing?
Sure. Sure. tracing back to the beginning, and the conversation about political appointments and whether they should, whether it makes a difference that there is one on each side. Notwithstanding the argument that there is political favor banking and favor trading in politics, and certainly there's legislative compromise and everything like this, the evidence in this case really was quite different than that. The evidence in this case was that the defendant had a host of serious problems he was facing, and he considered the Senate seat appointment a windfall that would help him solve those problems. This was not about him just looking for a political advancement or another way to serve the public, and at a minimum, the jury was entitled, based on the evidence, to reach that conclusion.
He was not too happy when the word was received from the President's office that they appreciated his offer, right?
Yes, appreciation and gratitude, yes. Exactly right. Excellent. When he was offered a political favor or a political banking there, he snubbed his nose at it and had absolutely no interest in anything like that. And the defendant made crystal clear over and over again that he was not about to appoint anyone, Barack Obama's choice for the Senate seat or anybody else, unless he got something in return. And so this case is really, really very different than any of the historical examples that he gave. And to make this distinction in a case like this really is not good legal doctrine, as you were asking, Judge Rovner. What that does is it means that a public official can do what private parties cannot. And the reason that they've got this opportunity to trade an official act for money, property, or thing of value is because they have access to a currency that private citizens have no access to, and that's the official acts that they can sell. That just can't be right. When you have it on the evidence here, given the defendant's clear message that he wanted something for himself and he was not going to trade that Senate seat appointment or make that Senate seat appointment for anything other than that, then I think it's clear that this is not anything like the context of general political horse trading.
You know, I'm going to go back to the horses for just a second, because Attorney Quinlan said to Mr. Harris that the governor's delay in signing the racetrack bill is what you think, quote, is what you think, quote. Now, as I understand it, that statement was not admitted for its truth, but to establish Mr. Harris's state of mind. But in closing, government counsel argued that Bill Quinlan confirms that's exactly what the defendant is doing. And that sounds to me like that statement was used for its truth.
Your Honor, we argued in the brief, and it is our perception that when that statement was made, it was made in the context of the prosecutor's description of the evidence. This was the statement of the chronology of what occurred, and this was what occurred. I mean, what happened was that Harris was concerned. He talked to Quinlan, and Quinlan talked to him and opined that his fears were correct. And then that led to Harris backing out of the arrangements. He just stepped out of it and stopped advocating for the signature, which is what he was doing up until then. The prosecutor did not argue that, essentially, Quinlan said this was a quid pro quo. Jury, you should find that, too. And it's true that there's an inartfulness about the way that the statement was made, but the context of the statement... Well, it's inartful when it's pulled out of context. Then it really does, you know, it tends to sound out of context the way that you are hearing it.
Well, you call it inartful. I call it damaging.
Well, it would have been damaging, we would agree, I think, if the prosecutor had made the statement as part of its argument on the elements. But what the prosecutor was doing there was describing all of the facts that the jury had heard about this incident, and then at the end went through the elements dealing with the quid pro quo and did not mention that piece at all. Now, the evidence on that case or the evidence on that episode was much, much broader than the stray comment from Quinlan. And there's no reason to, and the jury, of course, had legal instructions and was instructed over and over again to rely on those in assessing the evidence. So I think that a single, and by the way, this single statement that we're talking about is an absolute minute portion of the overall argument, and also of the argument.
In your view, it's minute, but who knows how it hits a jury? I mean, in the same way, I have been wondering what was the purpose of eliciting the fact that Mr. Blagojevich had an attorney with expertise in criminal law. I mean, if there's no advice of counsel defense or a cheek defense.
Well, that's the problem, Your Honor, is that throughout the case, the defendant actually presented an advice of counsel defense. Every effort was made to resolve this issue prior to trial. Every possible effort was made by the court to keep the defendant's testimony on the straight and narrow here and prevent or attempt to prevent him from straying off into areas that the court had ruled inadmissible. And the point here is that, as in Joshua, there really is no distinction between a good faith defense and an advice of counsel defense when your good faith defense relies almost exclusively on the fact that you'd been talking to all these lawyers and they never said they never said boo about what you were proposing. And that is precisely what the defendant
put. But the question was never asked, am I doing the right thing? Is there anything wrong with what I'm doing, at least as far as the...
Absolutely not. And in
so
even
you
even
have to infer that, right?
You'd have to infer that. Well,
in other words, he asked his staff to do things. Nobody ever said, Governor, you can't do that.
Well, actually, there was evidence that on one occasion, Bill Quinlan and John Harris did tell him that he couldn't do something. And that was actually early on in the 501c money. But beside that, his general statement was that I'm talking to all these lawyers, and of course during his testimony, you know, the transcript reveals, you know, multiple occasions where he gilded the lily, I think the court said, in terms of going on about all the legal qualifications that his staff members had. And he basically says, I relied on the fact that they were silent. The district court noted.
That was my point.
Yes. Absolutely right.
He didn't pose the question of, can I do this, except perhaps in that one.
No, he sometimes posed the question, can I do this, but it was in the context of tactics. Can I accomplish this? Will they give this to me? Do you think I should ask for that? But it was never in never ever asked in the context of a legal opinion. And if he had raised an actual advice of counsel defense, if he had had the ability to do that because he had the facts to support it, that is, that he had requested advice from a lawyer and had received that advice and had told the lawyer everything that was pertinent to that advice, received the advice, and then acted in accordance with that advice, had that been the case.
Does the governor's office have a legal counsel?
Yes.
Yes, but in this case, yes, right. In this case, though, what was going on, the government would have had the opportunity, had he done that, to explore, investigate advice he may have received from other lawyers. Well, the defendant never waived the privilege with respect to his other lawyers, despite the fact that during this entire period, the defendant was represented by criminal counsel, including one of his lawyers during the trial. And also including, as you know, Winston and Strawn, who represented him during the time of his interviews with the FBI earlier in this investigation.
I want to talk to you about something else, and that's the exclusion of the Lisa Madigan recordings, please, because the defense points out that Judge Zagel excluded the recorded discussions of appointing Lisa Madigan to the Senate seat, which the defense believed were more favorable to the governor in terms of his motives, and that the government then told the jury in closing, go and see how many times her name is mentioned on the tapes. Now, what I'm trying to figure out is, was that fair, given that the judge had kept out the Lisa Madigan recordings?
Well, starting from the beginning,
we'll be here a long time.
Well, the beginning of your question. The court properly precluded the defendant from testifying or from generally saying that he believed his conduct was legal and properly precluded the particular tapes that the defendant offered or wanted to offer with respect to his state of mind. The defendant offered those tapes to prove that he had wanted to appoint Lisa Madigan, that she was always his first choice, that he was serious about her, and that all of the other, his theory was that all of the other things that had been discussed were what he called negative leverage to attempt to get people to go along, to get Madigan to go along, Madigan and Obama to help him put the quote-unquote mega deal or Lisa Madigan deal together. Of course, the evidence proved exactly the opposite, which was that Lisa Madigan was the negative leverage that he and John Harris agreed to use with Tom Balanoff, and they discussed that very clearly and unambiguously on a tape that was on November 3rd. The defendant offered a large number of tapes that for the stated purpose, and those tapes were not probative of the point that he sought to make with them for a host of different reasons. And among those reasons is that the conversations, some of them reflected the state of mind of other people rather than the defendant. The statements on the calls were susceptible to multiple interpretations. That was almost always the case. The interpretation that the defendant was proposing was contradicted flatly by other evidence that the defendant had put on, and that the statements were intended as negative leverage that there were a number of these calls where it's clear that that's exactly what was going on here, is that Lisa Madigan was being referred to as negative leverage. I mean, the defendant essentially contended in the district court that any call containing the name or the word Lisa or Lisa Madigan was evidence of his intent to appoint her, and that just isn't the case, quite obviously. The district court carefully considered each and every tape proposed by the defendant, listened to them, read the transcripts, discussed them, and asked about, you know, the details of why they were being presented and what the defendant thought that they proved, and made rulings, careful rulings, with respect to each of them. Most of the rulings, and certainly all of the rulings with respect to any tape that could even vaguely be considered as probative of the defendant's state of mind relevant to Lisa Madigan, even when it was excluded, the court ruled that it was subject to reevaluation after the defendant testified.
Well, I mean, the court excluded 32 of the 33 tapes.
Well,
so you're saying that
the defendant, I believe, wound up putting on five tapes at the end of the day. But the point is that most of the tapes were excluded subject to defendant's testimony. And the court ruled initially with respect to the tapes that they were not proof of state of mind standing alone. Remember that the defendant sought to admit these tapes instead of testifying. That was the defendant's original plan and original goal.
But wouldn't those tapes have documented his good faith effort to appoint Lisa Madigan in exchange for Speaker Michael Madigan's assistance in moving forward his legislative agenda?
No, Your Honor, they really wouldn't.
And would that have been criminal as well?
Well, as to the first question, they really would not have. They would not have. They did not. Not one of them did. And, in fact, regardless of whether they did or they didn't, the defendant testified to virtually every one of the conversations that were reflected by those tapes. So, in fact, the jury did hear.
Oh, but there's such a difference between a defendant testifying and hearing the words.
That's really true. And the difference was in the defendant's favor in this case, because the defendant provided a description of the calls in multiple cases that were far more favorable than the evidence actually was. And that partly explained why he did not seek to admit the tapes afterwards, as he was invited to by the judge. Because instead of cross-examination based on recent fabrication, the government, when it did cross-examine the defendant regarding his description of tapes, cross-examined him based on his efforts to mischaracterize the nature of the conversation. So, of course, in that context, he had no interest in coming back and putting on the tapes, because it would have established that, in fact, his characterization of the tapes had been incorrect. So it's very, very important to focus on the fact that the court offered him an opportunity to revisit the issue, and after he had testified and been cross-examined, he elected not to take the court up on that opportunity. That's very telling about the nature of the tapes, and it demonstrates that there really was not an issue there.
Speaking of horse racing, what was the law changing with regard to campaign contributions at this time? I mean, there was a push to get the money contributed before the end of the year.
Yes, Your Honor, but the law had to do with there was a new ethics law that had gone into effect that was going to cabin the defendant's right to solicit campaign contributions from, I don't know whether it's persons or companies with business with the state. So he had to get in the contributions from, for example, the racetrack before January 1st, because afterwards he could not solicit campaign contributions from them.
Could not solicit.
Could not. And as far as your other question about the use of the campaign funds, that law also changed during part of the time that was during this general time period. I don't remember exactly when that was. but it's not clear that the defendant was incapable or could not use his funds.
Could use it for some things and not others, probably.
Well, and he did use his campaign funds to pay his legal expenses during the investigation. And this isn't the question of during the trial. This is during the investigation. And that was one of the things that depleted his campaign funds to the point where it was a major concern to him at the time of all these events. Your Honor, I do want to mentioned the accusation of a bait and switch by the district court. There was no bait and switch here. There was no bait and switch here. The defendant.
The way you view it is that the judge had never actually made a definitive ruling on the cheat defense, and that only once Mr. Blagojevich got on the stand was this issue presented for decision. That's your view.
Well. That is my view, but the view is also supported by the record. The court said, I'm telling you this not to dictate the results, but to give you a chance to tell me I'm wrong, and characterize this issue as one that has not yet arisen, may never arise, and for which no decision is called for. And we know that the defendant did not believe that he had a final favorable ruling on this issue and did not rely on that belief, because he sought a ruling from the district court prior to presenting the evidence. And that establishes beyond doubt that there was no misunderstanding on his part, that this was a live issue that had not been resolved. And in addition to that.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, we would just ask that the conviction and sentence be affirmed in this case for all the reasons that we've stated here and in our briefs. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Goodman?
Yes. First of all, I would like to address the issue of the Madigan deal, which Judge Rovner pointed out. The government's theory was this was all for personal benefit, and they certainly highlighted excerpts from the tapes, but there was abundant evidence that contradicted that. First of all, if he was only interested in personal benefit, he could have looked for jobs in the private sector that would have paid much more. The evidence is clear that even with respect to the 501c4, it was an issue advocacy organization that he thought was going to carry on his work as governor and would give him a job when he left. Now, the Madigan deal, the government concedes that's not a private gain. That was for legislation. And the government diminished it at trial and said, no, this was just a stalking horse. It wasn't real. But there were dozens of tapes where he's negotiating the deal. The government stood up and told the jury, don't believe him. He's a liar. Go back and look at the tapes. You won't see any corroboration. Now, the government argues, well, he got to talk about it on direct, but they told the jury he was lying. And he didn't have the tapes to back him up. He has a right to present evidence that rebuts the government's theory. And the same is with the advice of counsel. The government took the position that he had all these lawyers around him and he never consulted with them. There's dozens of tapes where he's consulting on the very crimes that he's charged with. He's consulting with his general counsel. He's consulting with his chief of staff. He's consulting with everyone. On all of these issues, those tapes were excluded. The government said
consulting. Consulting is a broad term. He never, except for perhaps the one that I mistakenly thought didn't occur. Can I do this?
Well, first of all, with respect to the political deal, yes, he did not qualify for advice of counsel because he didn't go to a lawyer in advance because he never thought this was problematic. But he discussed it with his lawyers. Dozens of times. So, yes, with respect to the extortion issue, these extortion counts, now, the government concedes there was no the instructions were erroneous. Ms. Bonamici doesn't even contest that the instructions did not satisfy McCormick. Here we have a situation where the convictions are based on no explicit threats. We have, for Magoon, there's a single conversation in which Robert Blagojevich asked him to raise money by January 1st. That's it, that Magoon interpreted as some hidden message in there. And with respect to Johnston was a longtime contributor to Blagojevich, and he had made a commitment to raise this money well before this issue arose with the racetrack. So these are very weak charges. The instruction error cannot possibly be deemed harmless. Now, with respect to Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical, Mr. Blagojevich cited the exact same hypothetical as one of his reasons for informing him that this was not criminal. And it just simply cannot be that the only time you have a right to disagree with the government's version of the law is when you have an advice of counsel defense. If you consult with counsel beforehand, you have a right to contest the law, but if you don't, you cannot. That simply cannot be the law. He had a right to defend against the mens rea. He did not believe these were crimes. He believed this was political horse trading. With respect to the Jesse Jackson, just briefly, the evidence here, first of all, these counts have to be reversed because these are campaign contribution counts, and the McCormick instruction clearly was not harmless error. And the good faith instruction, because when the jury was deliberating on these counts, they all were already deciding, well, the judge has instructed me that he does not have good faith because he attempted to do a trade. The evidence for the Jesse Jackson was shockingly weak. We have an illegal offer made in October, and then in December he tells his brother to go talk to the donor, who just happened to be a longtime contributor to the Blagojevich campaign, longtime supporter. The next day he cancels the meeting. The message, first of all, there was a tape that was excluded, which would have made this even more clear that it was a lawful message. But even from the evidence that's in the record, the message delivered to this donor was, tell him he's a realistic candidate and that he needs to start showing support for the governor. That is a lawful message. That is not an extortionate message. It's the same message given to anyone seeking a political appointment. You're realistic. No promises can be made. No promises can be made, but if you show support for the president, you might get an ambassadorship. If you show support for the governor, you might get a political appointment. So, Judge, based on all of these errors, we beg the court to look closely at this record, and I don't think that this court could find that Mr. Blagojevich got a fair trial.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Goodman.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement.